Welcome to Truth for Life. Today, Alistair Begg continues a study about ordinary men and women found in the Bible, people through whom God accomplished extraordinary things. Our subject today is a man whose commitment and integrity landed him in a den full of lions. Alistair Begg calls the message Five Words on Daniel. We're in Daniel chapter 6.
He was distinguished. He was despised. He was disciplined. Actually, this characteristic of Daniel's life was the foundation of their plot. They knew that they could count on one thing in Daniel, and that is that he would be absolutely consistent. Some of our Christian lives are like human cannonballs. You know, a great surge of energy. We come flying out the end of the thing and fall in a net and lie there for days on end. Well, that wasn't Daniel. He was like a Rolls-Royce engine on a 747. Once they cranked him up, he just kept going and going and going and going. And so his friend said, we'll get him on the basis of his consistency. So they show up at his house. If your Bible is open, you'll see it there in verse 11. They went as a group. These men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. They weren't surprised. They knew they would. So they shoot off back to the king. They said, you know, we want to remind you of your royal decree. Which one? The one, you know, that we thought up for you a few days ago where you were going to shut everything down for 30 days. And eventually he said, oh, yeah, I'm with you. I've got that. And having caught Daniel, now they catch the king. And they say, by the way, you know, you said that anybody who wasn't doing this would be thrown in the lion's den. The king says, yeah, you're dead right. The decree stands. You can imagine him just kind of waking up to it in accordance with the laws of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be repealed. Then they said to the king, hey, Daniel, who's one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the decree. In fact, he still prays three times a day. He's not paying attention to you. That wasn't true. I wonder if any of us have the impression that Daniel's activity in prayer was some kind of reactionism to the king's edict. In other words, he became a sort of political insurrectionist as a result of what had suddenly come down from the equivalent of Washington, D.C. Was it a display of defiance? After all, it would be one thing for him to pray briefly, to pray quietly, but with the windows open and three times a day, that's something special, don't you think? Well, actually, that perception is absolutely false. And most of the little books, the little Bible books with a picture of Daniel praying, are completely bogus, if you'll pardon me. Because most of them, at least the ones that I had as a wee boy, had him praying in front of a big picture window. You know, like it was the end of the high street and everybody was going up and down and Daniel was kind of like doing his thing for all the public as they passed by. No. The history and architecture of the time points to the fact that Daniel's house would have been as other houses. And the windows were not at ground level. The windows were up high. And not only were they up high, but they were small. And the reason they were small and up high was to protect from the heat and from the robbers. Therefore, the picture is not so much of Daniel posturing in public as it is of the evil hearts of these characters who invade his legitimate privacy and prize him out of his routine activity. Well, you notice very carefully that for Daniel, when the crisis hit, it did not create his disciplined lifestyle. It revealed it. When crisis hits a marriage, it reveals the strength of the marriage. When crisis hits a school, it reveals the character and caliber of the leadership of the school or the student body, whatever it might be. It reveals what is there. Oh, yes, it has an impact. Yes, it does create certain things. But the first thing it does is it shows up what's there. And when the crisis hit, it showed up where Daniel was. He had made prayer such a habit in his life that probably the very momentum of the custom of praying itself would have been enough for him to stay faithful, with or without a sense of inspiration. You understand what I'm saying? that he was so committed to praying disciplined prayer in this way that he prayed whether he felt like it or whether he didn't feel like it. See, most of us begin our plans on the basis of a feeling in our tummy, you know. Well, I really feel I ought to do this. And we do it as long as we feel we ought to do it. And then when we don't feel we ought to do it, we close it down for a while. That has nothing to do with discipline. And why didn't you pray at the prayer meeting? Well, I didn't feel like praying at the prayer meeting. For goodness sake, what is prayer? A glandular condition or something? Jesus said, man ought always to pray and not to faint. That's good enough for me. It's a prayer meeting, pray. We didn't all come together, sit in silence, for goodness sake. We could have done that and unhooked our telephones and laid them down on our bedside tables and laid on our beds in total silence. The discipline of his life. Probably there were times when he felt like praying and other times when he didn't feel like praying. There were times when he got a great surge out of it, and there were other times when, frankly, he got nothing out of it. There were times when he left feeling really blessed, and there were other times when he left feeling really flat. But he didn't care. He prayed because he prayed because he prayed. That's discipline. In fact, in relationship to the edict that had come down, he could probably by this time have rationalized the fact that he'd stored up such a phenomenal credit on the strength of all the things that he'd done for God that God would let him off for 30 days. Don't you think you and I would have rationalized a little bit like that? Isn't that what you do when you go on vacation? Well, I don't think I need to go to church this Sunday. After all, I've been going to church for the last 51 Sundays. Who cares? Since when was that a New Testament question? Or he could have said, you know, I've got a sneaking suspicion that I'm soon going to be home out of here. Would be a dreadful thing to get my head chopped off or eaten up by lions just when I'm about to go home and see some of my old friends and my old cousins and my own family. And he could have said to himself, you know, I think the Lord, he won't mind if I shut it down just for a little while after, you know, 30 days goes past very quickly, especially at my age. He says, you know, 75 or 80 years and I've been praying up a storm for years, Lord, you know. Never even entered his head, apparently. He just was straight at it the same way as ever. Bam, you know, bam, bam, praying. You ever been in the company of somebody like that? The kind of involuntary reaction of their life is prayer. I got a little friend called T.S. Mooney. I may have told you about him before. He's living in heaven for the last little while. He was a bachelor all of his days. He taught a boys' Bible class for 50 years of his life. He was a banker. The boys' Bible class that he taught was in Londonderry, Northern Ireland. I asked him one day, I said, what's your plan and purpose with these boys? He answered instantaneously, my plan for the Bible class has always been to give every boy a Bible in his hand, a Savior in his heart, and a purpose in his life. Straight out. Every boy that came to his class, he prayed for, always. By the time I met him, he was in his 70s, and when I went to his apartment in Londonderry, it was like a rogues gallery. There were photographs all around the walls. There were judges from the High Court in London. There were famous surgeons. There were school teachers. There were mechanics. There were plumbers. There were all kinds of people all around. And who were they? They were his boys. And I counted it an amazing thing as an apostle, one untimely born, to be added to the list and to get my face in the rogues gallery. And he used to write to me and say, I remember you daily at the best place. And I believed him. I met a young man the other day. He said to me, I pray for you every Tuesday. And I believed him. Whose ministry is being held up on the strength of our disciplined commitment to prayer? We can do more than pray after we've prayed, but we can do more than pray until we've prayed. If our prayer is meager, it's because we regard it as something supplemental rather than as something fundamental. And for this guy, Daniel, it was fundamental. It was like breathing. It was like putting on his sandals. It was like drinking Diet Coke, whatever it was, you know. He was absolutely committed to it. Incidentally, T.S. Mooney died a few years ago. The housekeeper found him in the morning, fully dressed and kneeling over his bed. He had gone into the presence of Jesus on his knees. She called for two young men, one a headmaster, another young man who had grown up through his Bible class, and they came to the house, and they lifted T.S. Mooney's body off the floor, and as they prized him back from the bed, they pulled up the little black book that he used to keep alongside his Bible that was wrapped in a rubber band, and they looked down to find their names amongst the list of many names. It was morning. It was time to pray. And he was praying. Loved ones, the door is wide open for that kind of consistent commitment. If you are prepared as a young man or a young woman tonight to say, wherever he takes me, whatever I do, whatever I'm going to become, I know I can be that. And so it was that Daniel displayed his discipline in his prayer. Now there's two words left, you know that. So let me just give you the two remaining words. The first word was he was distinguished by his quality and his integrity. The second word was that he was despised. The third word, which I've just dealt with, I've forgotten. And the fourth word, what was it? Discipline. And the fourth word was he was dumped. That's why you should never feel bad if you've forgotten, you know. I fall asleep reading my notes on Saturday evenings. And so I'm never surprised when people fall asleep listening to my notes on Sunday mornings. The fourth word is he was dumped. Dumped. Okay? Verse 16. So the king gave the order, they brought Daniel, and they threw him in the lion's den. The king was trapped by his own poor piece of legislation. Verse 14 tells us he was greatly distressed, that he was determined to rescue Daniel, that he made every effort until sundown to save him. He tried to introduce another bill, you know. He tried to put together enough people in the Congress who would vote to overturn his edict, and they all held absolutely true. No way. We've got old Daniel this time. Daniel's going down. Bye-bye, Daniel. We are going to dump him once and for all. And the fact of the matter is that Daniel would not be here in chapter 6 were it not for the commitment that he declared in chapter 1 with his passion for purity. He would not be here at the age of 70 and 80 were it not for the persistence that he'd shown through his middle years. Daniel's life was, in the phrase I used the other evening, a long obedience in the same direction, and so he was dumped. Verse 16 actually says that they threw him into the lion's den. The architecture of the time and a little bit of historical and archaeological research reveals that in these kind of structures, there was a ramp for the animals and a hole for the victim. It causes me to say that every putrefying culture will take more concern of its animals than it will of its human beings. And we are living in such a culture. The decision from a human perspective in dumping him was irreversible. A stone was brought, placed over the mouth of the den. The king sealed it with his own signet ring and the rings of his nobles so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. In other words, it was a joint deal. They wanted to make sure the king didn't bail out, and he was stuck with the fact that they were determined not to. And the evening passes with nobody eating. Verse 18. The king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without entertainment being brought to him. And he could not sleep. He wasn't eating. The lions weren't eating. Daniel wasn't eating. Nobody was eating. And as soon as dawn came, at the first light of dawn, you can imagine him just waiting, pulling the blinds and going, I got to get down there. The king got up and hurried to the lion's den. And when he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, because he didn't know what he was going to find. Brings me to my last word. Daniel was delivered. Calls out in a strangulated voice. Can you imagine him shouting? Because he doesn't expect he's getting any answer, right? Daniel! That's not strangulated enough. I'm not going to mimic it. He shouts into the darkness. And you imagine Daniel going, yeah? It's like, hey, chill out, King. No problem. Verse 21, Daniel said, hey, King, live forever. My God sent his angel. He shut the mouths of the lions. They haven't hurt me. Reason, I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I ever done any wrong before you, O King. See, that's a passion for purity. That's consistency. That's integrity. You can't say that unless you have lived that. Neither can I. The reason that the angels came and shut the mouths of the lions was because I was absolutely innocent. It was a trumped-up charge. I've never done anything wrong before you, O King. And the king was overjoyed, and he gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. You see the difference now? He gets dumped in, he gets lifted out. You know, it's very hard not to read these verses and have your mind shoot forward in biblical history, is it not? To see a foreshadowing here of Calvary? Another one on trumped-up charges? Another one despised and rejected by those to whom he had done no wrong? Another one who was left behind a sealed den? Another one who had a stone rolled in front of the entranceway to prevent his exit? And then in the first light of dawn, the discovery made, he is alive. And here in Daniel 6, there is a foreshadowing of that day when the lion will lie down with the lamb and will eat straw like an ox. An inbreaking, as it were, of the kingdom that is yet to come in anticipation of the day when the king comes to reign. And suddenly Darius's eyes are opened as a result of this encounter, and he issues another decree. He calls for the worship of Daniel's God. Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, the nations, and the men of every language throughout the land. He says, listen, Daniel's God lives. Daniel's God reigns. Daniel's God rescues. Daniel's God performs signs and wonders. Small wonder in verse 28 that we read that Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Why? Because he was the embodiment of a man with a passion for purity. Empires come and go, kings rise and fall, fashions and lifestyles change, but God's truth never changes. It was in an event like this, many years ago, at a different college, but a similar context, that one young man, on the strength of this kind of exhortation and encouragement, went back to his room, took his journal, opened it, wrote down the date of the day, tautology, wrote down the date, and penned, he is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. And Eliot said, that is going to be my life. You say to yourself, well, I'm not Eliot. He wasn't Jim Eliot then, you know what I mean? Well, he was Jim Eliot, but he wasn't, you know, like Jim Eliot. You know what I mean? He was just Jim. His last name happened to be Eliot. And now we know him. Because in the privacy of his life, he made this kind of commitment. I want to encourage you young folks tonight to make sure, like in cross-country running, don't get with a crowd that hangs around at the back. And there will be a crowd like that. There is in every school. Don't hang around with those people. You've run about 150 yards and they start to say things like, well, we don't really need to do this. They start to say things like, well, you know, there's no need to be fanatical about this. And eventually, they just get further and further and further behind. And then they criticize the people who are running hard out in front. Look at him. Look at her. Who does she think she is? A Let me tell you something. Run out and run hard. Oh, you say, but I'm not much. I'm just me. No one knows. Listen, God knows. Canon Farrar, in an earlier generation, wrote these words in his journal. I am only one, but I am one. I cannot do everything, but I can do something. And what I can do, I ought to do. And what I ought to do, by the grace of God, I will do. If this was Scotland, we would finish with the chorus. But I've looked in your book and it's not there. This is how it goes. Dare to be a Daniel. Dare to stand alone. Dare to have a purpose firm. And dare to make it known. And for you ladies, let's just change it ever so slightly. Dare to be a Danielle. For if truth were told, the pages of 20th century missionary biography have more testimonies to this kind of caliber in the lives of young women than ever in the lives of young men. So although he was a Daniel, why don't you then be a Daniel?
A challenging message from Alistair Begg as he continues our study called Jars of Clay. This is Truth for Life. Well, if you're familiar with the full story of Daniel, you know he was still a young man when he was taken from his homeland and brought to Babylon. But despite his youth, he was committed to following God. Of course, it's never too late to make that commitment. But what a wonderful advantage when you begin your adult life with that foundation already in place. With that in mind, we want to recommend a book today written to help parents and youth leaders address questions from teenagers about faith and other issues facing their generation. The book is simply titled Ask. It's written by pastor and apologist David Robertson, and he addresses a broad mix of topics, questions posed by teenagers on things like suicide, understanding the mind of God, what's the purpose of life. There's even a question about tattoos. Robertson addresses 52 different questions and provides suggested books for further reading on every topic covered in the book. Robertson's book, Ask, helps students learn how to think through the lens of Scripture. Each chapter also features a key biblical text, a discussion on the topic, along with a closing prayer. This is a go-to reference book, something you'll want to have on hand as you answer your teenager's questions to help guide them to think biblically during high school and college years. We'll send you a copy along with our thanks when you donate today to support Truth for Life. Your gift helps bring Alistair's clear, relevant Bible teaching to people all around the world, without cost being a barrier. And we are so grateful. Look for the book titled Ask when you donate online at truthforlife.org/donate or call 888-588-7884. Again, that's 888-588-7884. If you'd prefer to mail your donation, our address is Truth for Life, P.O. Box 39-8000, Cleveland, Ohio, 44139. I'm Bob Lapine, hoping you can join us tomorrow. We'll talk about trusting God in the dark valleys of life. This daily program features the Bible teaching of Alistair Begg, and it's furnished by Truth for Life, where the learning is for living.